pop yourself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some moody clips of popcorn fighting fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxings, full month horror movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on, contests, and of course you know it's all about games. That's a slow down, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast. The other Jason.
Welcome back to Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. Today is a call-in episode, and I've got a number of calls on things like skills, on the most recent movie Monday, and also on whether classes should be able to pick up and use, classes in D&D, that is, should be able to pick up and use weapons they normally aren't allowed to by class. That part gets a little bit spicy, so it's saved for the end of the episode. I just want to throw out there are a bunch of other great podcasts out there, so make sure you're checking those out. In particular, I want to call out my friend Eric Salzwedel over at the Omega 3D Chicken Coop, who's recently started putting out new episodes, interview episodes, and he's done a series that I happen to be on one of those, but he's talking about if you're going to introduce a new player to RPGs, what game should you pick? If you're a GM introducing a new player, what game should you pick? And then if you're new to GMing, what game should you pick? So interesting discussions there with some interesting guests. Go check that out. The link is in the show notes. Also, a real quick shout out for the online convention BSRCon 3 that's going to be happening in January. The signups for the games are open now. The link for that is also in the show notes. And now, let's get to that mailbag.
Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Well, maybe it's your auntie or a joke by your spouse, but the operator's screaming is coming from inside the house.
Yo, Jason, so I'm calling in about my thoughts about the thoughts of other people on Krull. That was an awesome episode. I say it every time, but I love this whole idea. It's been a lot of fun. I wanted to call in because I wanted to sort of answer one of Spencer's questions, which, Spencer, your message was absolutely amazing, dude. I was literally in my room, like, it's like 11 o'clock at night, laughing my ass off when I was listening to your message, Spencer. But you asked why the big bad would be interested in the princess. Well, that's because whoever is the father of that princess's kid, that kid is going to rule the universe. So if the big bad could have gotten the princess pregnant, the big bad's kid would have ruled the universe, or the galaxy, not the universe, just the galaxy. But yeah, that's why the big bad was interested in the princess. And, you know, as some folks pointed out, like, how is the kid going to rule the galaxy? All they have is swords and horses. But, you know, they do have now, even though a lot of it, as Dark Fluid pointed out, got sucked up into the air when the castle got destroyed, which, as he pointed out, was friggin' amazing that it blew up instead of out. Just awesome stuff. But I'm sure there's still some remains of high technology that those people could work with and combine with magic to figure stuff out. And then, boom, bang, you got a galaxy-ruling empire. At least that's what goes on in my head canon at the end of the movie, as they start working, figuring out some of this technology stuff. Anyway, man, awesome, awesome, awesome calls from everybody. Somebody did mention that they hope, or that it'd be cool if the movie got remade. I disagree with that. I hope to God it never gets remade. I really, really, really hope it never gets remade. I don't think it would be good. But yeah, man, that's it. Awesome stuff. Thank you again for putting this together, Jason. Thank you again, Henchman, for coming up with the idea. And thank you again to everybody who called in and watched the movie. Y'all had amazing things to say. Anyway, take it easy. Peace out.
Joe, thank you for those kind words. I, too, really enjoy Movie Mondays. Movie Mondays are the brainchild of Goblin's Henchman, who came up with the idea that we should all watch. And all includes anybody that wants to participate. There's no limiters here. But a movie is picked. Everybody watches that movie. They send their thoughts in about that movie, either audio messages or an email or a text. And then the last Monday of the month, a show is put out that has all those thoughts included in it. And we just had the one for Crawl, which was last month's movie. Next month's movie, of course, are the Conan films for a Conan Christmas. If you're interested in contributing to that, you can pick any of the Conan movies, including Red Sonja. Watch it, send your thoughts in about it, and they'll all be played on 25 December. You need to have all those submissions in by the 22nd of December, and all the ways to do that are in the show notes. As far as Spencer, yep, Spencer's a big movie guy, and a lot of people on the Discord also commented about Spencer's call-in for Crawl. This has a channel on the Audio Dungeon Discord, by the way. There's a link to that in the show notes if you want to go check that out. As far as a remake goes, I hate to tell you, Joe, but J.J. Abrams is on tap to remake Crawl, so buckle your seatbelt for that. Now we're going to switch gears and we're going to talk about post-apocalyptic D&D. I have calls from both Joe and Carl, who does the Geomologist Presents podcast, and now also has some exclusive YouTube content, so don't forget to check that out as well.
Hey, yo, Jason, just getting into your latest mailbag episode. And, yeah, there seems to be this divide between D&D being a post-apocalyptic setting or a Western medieval setting. But those two things are kind of the same thing. Like, especially late medieval period, that was a post-apocalyptic setting, man. Like, the Black Death rolled through Europe, what, like 1340s-ish, 50s-ish, and just beat the shit out of Europe, wiped out everybody. So, and then the medieval period ended in the mid to late 1400s. So for 100 years of the Middle Ages, it was a post-apocalypse. And the reason there are so many tombs and dungeons and ruins in D&D and gold laying around all over the place and treasure is because there used to be a civilization there that is no longer there. So yeah, I don't see this distinction between it is either post-apocalyptic or Western medieval. It's one and the same. It's both los dos, which means both in Spanish. I don't know why I just went to Spanish, but anyway, so yeah, man, I don't know. That's just what I've been thinking about. Take it easy, dude. Peace out.
Jason, calling in from your Comedy Gold for your Comedy Gold podcast. And I kind of tend to agree, you know, with what you've been saying and what M.W. Lewis said. You know, as far as Dungeons and Dragons goes and the setting, it is on purpose a mishmash and a hodgepodge of, that's probably the same thing, of genres. Or periods, really, but still keeping to that sort of roughly medieval European, early Renaissance European aesthetic. But what's curious is, right, about post-apocalyptic, I mean, the medieval world, or really the early medieval period, was kind of post-apocalyptic, right? After the fall of Rome, it was warlords and different, it was anarchy after the fall of Rome. And different tribes were conquering around, trying to get their piece of old Rome. And things really didn't sort of settle, at least in Western Germany and present-day France, until Charlemagne kind of took over. And then someone had mentioned earlier, like, look at Pendragon. Pendragon becomes this strange amalgamation of late Roman period to high medieval, you know, when you have like a Norman period, if you look at the game, all this is all intermixed, or everything sort of changes as Arthur becomes more powerful and powerful, or Camelot becomes more decadent. So, you know, the games kind of do this on purpose. And if you really wanted a realism in a realistic medieval system, well, use like Harnworld. It definitely buys into the medieval period where gold is very scarce and there's a more of a silver-based economy, right? I mean, just play that. But then, and then you have guilds and all the trappings of a medieval type of world, probably late medieval. Of course, you have magic and monsters, but, you know, like MW says, you got to consult the dragons and the goblins and the orcs to see what really happened, right? But that is funny, this notion of post-apocalypticness, right? So just another one that comes to mind is the Bronze Age collapse that led to the classic Greek period. That was a period of anarchy and chaos that, in the minds of the people who were living it, was probably mythical and apocalyptic. So there you go. There has been apocalypse in our history, and societies build off that collapse of a previous society, right?
Okay, guys, thank you for those thoughts. Like Joe said, why not both? And I think it is a combination of both, really. Carl gave us a lot of interesting insight on real Europe and kind of the post-apocalyptic idea of that. Although, when I'm talking about post-apocalyptic, I should probably clarify, because I mean it more in the science fiction or science fantasy sense, not so much in the real world sense. Maybe post-cataclysmic I should use. But the idea of like Thundar the Barbarian, or the idea of maybe Gamma World, the idea of all these civilizations in these novels and even in these games where you have super science and then that civilization collapses and rebuilds up from a Stone Age civilization. And that's kind of what we're looking at here. So that's what I mean with post-apocalyptic. I mean, not the idea of Rome is built up and then collapses and then we build up from there. Because Rome, I mean, when we look at it, you have the Byzantine Empire, you have Eastern Rome. So, you know, the Holy Roman Empire split, but it was never a total collapse. And then you had other civilizations that carried knowledge forward as well during that time. So it's not like man totally blacked out and rebuilt from scratch during that time. So depending how far man has to fall for it to be a post-apocalypse, I would actually say that the medieval period, Dark Ages, whatever we want to call it, but Europe, you know, it never really fell into a full apocalypse. It had a definite bad time, but it never had to restart from scratch, right? Where I think the idea here is some sort of, and to be fair, Gamma World and all doesn't really restart from scratch, right? But you know what I'm saying, or maybe you know what I'm saying, maybe not, maybe I'm just confusing people more. But in the D&D world and in a lot of these other games that I mentioned before, it was a super science kind of world that collapsed, and then they built back up from, you know, crawled back up from the Stone Age, and then we're slowly refining these super science things in addition to sorcery. Anyhow, great calls, guys. Thank you very much. Now, let's move on, because Carl has some thoughts on skills and wants to gush about the new Walking Dead RPG.
Yeah, I definitely agree the skill system has to be flexible, and it should not be a hard, fast, hardwired, in-stone rule that when you roll for this skill, that you use that attribute. Case in point, in Twilight 2000, when you are using heavy weapons for indirect fire, you actually use intelligence with heavy weapons instead of strength, right? So strength is a default, like if you're firing a machine gun, but you can use another attribute to couple with that skill. And there are talents that kind of do that too. I noticed in, like, for example, The Walking Dead, stealth can be used with empathy as opposed to manipulation to try to sneak your way out of a sticky situation and convince people to leave you alone or move on or something like that. Yeah, anyway, and I think what you said is kind of interesting about, you know, how to create a proper character. I think that's why I like the life path systems in a lot of these games. I think Walking Dead does suffer from the lack of a life path system. It'd be cool to import like the T2K life path system or something similar, you know, that you have a career beforehand and then you get various skills. I guess you'd end up getting more skills than using just the archetypes. Maybe there is going to be a supplement where you do like a life path system with Walking Dead, but I think they want the runner to make it like a rules light system and hold on to the narrative instead. But I think the life path system kind of makes it more like, okay, you gain these skills during your career. I guess Traveler did that first. I do like with Mongoose, with the Cepheus, I guess it's the OGL for Traveler. It is kind of cool that you are finding like a Traveler-like career path system using the Cepheus engine or using the Mongoose OGL for like Western or for like a medieval type D&D game, which I think is kind of cool.
Very cool, Carl. Thank you for those thoughts. Before I really comment on skills for this episode, I'm also going to play a call from Daniel because he also talks about skills. In a previous call, Carl asked Daniel to expand his thoughts on Coriolis as well. So we're going to hear that in skills. Daniel actually sent a really long call that I'm going to interrupt in the middle to discuss the skills, and then we'll move on to the next part of Daniel's call. So be aware, I am chopping his call up. But let's hear the first part right now.
Hey, Jason. Den of Bants keep calling in. A couple things. This is about the call-in episode. So, number one, to Carl. Yes, I should talk more about Coriolis. Coriolis is super fun. It's a beautiful game, and I love the idea of Arabian Nights in space in general. I wish I knew more about the stories. I really should read more of those. I just love it a lot, and it's such a cool game. I will say the organization is not great. It took me a little bit to really get into it, but man, once we started playing, what a great game. The engine, of course, and many of the things in it are used in a lot of other games. I believe the Alien game is pretty close to it because we played that and I was able to use some of my Coriolis skill to navigate that game. So yeah, very cool game. And as I mention all the time when somebody mentions it, I love the ship-to-ship combat in that. It's one of my favorite things. Jason, skills. So I love all the skill talk, and I agree with you. A shorter list of skills has been, you know, you guys were talking about like 4 skills per ability score, that kind of stuff is cool. You know what skill system actually is pretty darn good is the one in 5th edition, I think. And the reason I say that is because there are not that many skills. There might be more than I would want, but, you know, there's not that many. The skills are associated with ability scores, but you can use a different ability score if the situation calls for it. That's like baked into the system. So you could do a athletics check, which is normally strength, but you could also do it with con or let's say dex, depending on what you're doing. The other thing that's cool about it is that everybody has the ability to use them because, you know, it's just an ability score check. However, if you are proficient in it, then you get a bonus. So it doesn't create this weird situation where people can't try to do things. You may make an arcana check, even if you're not a wizard or whatever, you know, as long as you have an intelligence score, you can make that check. You may not make it because it might be incredibly high, but you can do it. So I think it's a pretty good system overall. And if I was doing a D20 system, I think that's what I would use. I definitely like it better than non-weapon proficiencies from second edition, personally. But anyways, there you go. There I am liking something in 5e better than second edition. Now, bunch of stuff about MW's call. Really good call. Really enjoyed it. First of all, I just want to say I love the idea and the point. And I totally agree with the idea that you got to make decisions at the table as a group sometimes. And I think that that's a great way to do it. Ask the players. And the game even tells you to do that. So maybe not AD&D. You know, AD&D says ask Gary. But, you know, I'm joking, of course. But the game in many places says ask the players. Come up with a consensus. So I think that's a great way to run the game. I really like that. Now, I don't know, I'm not familiar with Wilderness Survival Guide and that I think it's probably similar to second edition is my guess. But, you know, rolling under ability scores is something that people have done for a long time. And I think that, like many things, it's one of those things that just gets used maybe in the inappropriate space. That is to say, if I say I want to sneak and you tell me, OK, roll under dex, and you're counting that the same as a move silently, you know, that's not really fair to a thief, because even if I had a mediocre dex, that's going to be, you know, a fairly high level thief before you nail that 50%. That being said, I always look at the thieves' skills as more supernatural, so it's a little different. I would allow both, really, I guess. But yeah, so for a long time, I did that. And I still do it sometimes, where I would just fall back on that. But I try to avoid just rolling under ability scores for stuff, unless it's something just so generic. I wouldn't do it for picking a lock. I wouldn't do it for, you know, moving silently. I might do it for somebody that's not a thief to climb, you know, and because that's something that is not, it's like a standard thing, but it would never be better than a thief's ability again. And it wouldn't be for climbing sure surfaces. It would be just for climbing in general. So I love that idea.
Okay, so let's talk about skills. I do like the idea of having a limited number of skills. I like them under attributes, like four under each attribute, but I don't know that they have to be. And I definitely like the idea of the attributes influencing the use of the skills, depending how you're using them. You know, so if you're intimidating somebody, maybe you're doing it with your charisma, maybe you're doing it with your strength, depending what you're doing, right? And I think that's okay. I think having that flexibility is a good thing. So before we talk about skill lists, let's address the standard OSR thing that Daniel brings up near the end of that call from him, the idea of ability checks. And I 100% agree. Ability checks, rolling a d20 or even 3d6 under your attribute is way too easy. Yeah, you can change it. Oh, we'll roll 5d6 under your attribute. Yeah, you can do that kind of stuff. But let's be honest, if you're rolling under the attribute, it's going to be pretty easy. Now, you can make it a percentile roll under the attribute, right? And kind of the Gary system that was brought up over on MW's podcast was the idea that you take, it's a percentile roll, and you have the character's attribute, and then you have their level. And each level they have, I think, was worth 5%, and you multiply the levels. So a fifth level character adds 25% to their attribute. So if a fifth level character has a 15 attribute, you would have 15 plus 25, which is 40, so they'd have a 40% chance of succeeding. Now, I kind of like that if it's something kind of crazy that they're trying to do that they normally wouldn't be able to do, because it puts a lot of weight on their level and how experienced they are. And I think that's important, because an experienced adventurer is going to be able to bring in that world knowledge. But they shouldn't be just accomplishing things willy-nilly either. I agree that a skill system should never make them better than a class's inbuilt abilities. Having a skill, you should never be able to beat a thief at doing thief stuff, right? And that's why I'm a little ambiguous on the idea of Arcana and all, because maybe that should be the domain of wizards and clerics and things like that, right? But, you know, I don't know. Maybe. I think the other thing with skills are, though, we're talking adventurers. So if you're playing a Mudcore game, then maybe this is a little bit different. But if you're playing a heroic game, and AD&D is kind of supposed to be a heroic fantasy adventure game, right? So a lot of times you need to just let them succeed at what they're doing. Now, I'm not saying they automatically pick locks or automatically do, but maybe you just roll to see how long it takes them, right? And there are some things that they also shouldn't be able to do. It's okay if they can't get through that door and they have to go back to town and hire a specialist to come back to get through that door. Maybe they need a higher level thief to get through the door. Maybe they need a specialist to come in and read the runes that are on the door to figure out how to get in. But it's okay for characters not to be able to succeed at a task. Not everything should be possible. But I think as far as a lot of things we do skill checks for, maybe we shouldn't bother doing skill checks for, just let them do it. But I also kind of veer towards the idea of players being able to use their player knowledge and not being stuck in, well, would my character know how to do that kind of thing? But that's really going to be campaign dependent. When we look at the skill list, and Daniel brings up 5e. And the 5e skill list actually is pretty interesting. And so when we look at that, that also makes us look at the 4e skill list. And the 4e skill list and 5e skill list are kind of similar. Honestly, I think I kind of prefer the 4e skill list over the 5e skill list, looking at them. Now, I'm not really sure the differences in the rules and how they're implemented, but when we look at the 4e skill list, we have acrobatics, arcana, athletics, bluff, diplomacy, dungeoneering, endurance, heal, history, insight, intimidate, nature, perception, religion, stealth, streetwise, and thievery. Okay. I would probably drop thievery off this totally. You don't need it. If you're trying to do, if you're somebody trying to do a non-thief thing, well, either you can't do it or you're going to have to use one of these other things to try to do it. But for the most part, I think this 4E skill list is pretty good. 5E adds in animal handling. It breaks up thievery into a couple different skills. It adds an investigation skill, which I severely dislike. I would also remove perception because I think perception checks are the devil. If the players need to perceive things, they should ask questions. but to be fair, the DM has to be up to the challenge if you're going to remove perception. You have to give players a chance at that. I don't know. I mean, does D&D need a skill system? I mean, that's arguable too, if you even need one at all. But I think this could be an ongoing project to come up with a perfect skill system for D&D that hopefully you could graft onto any edition of D&D. Like I say, the Rule Cyclopedia version just, for me, has way too many skills, and some of those skills are feats, and some of the skills are better than the class abilities. So I think that kind of rounds that out, although I think you could modify and really chop down that number of lists, that number of skills. But again, the other issue with skills are, once you introduce skills, you're limiting what the other characters can do, and that's a problem. And that's where, like, ability checks come in. But then, you know, we start going down this, you know, it leads down the rabbit hole and gets into a kind of a quagmire. So you're probably best off, I don't know, you might be better off not doing skills at all. But I do appreciate all the thoughts on that. For me, because I'm getting ready to start a solo campaign, skills are kind of interesting because if I'm the GM and the player, then that kind of gets in the way of using player knowledge to solve problems. So for a solo game, I think there is a place in skills, more so than in a traditional game where you have a GM and separate players. Because in a solo game, how do you determine if the character knows that or not? Well, that's where skills really come in handy. That's why Pendragon is such a great solo system with just the way it's set up. I mean, obviously it's kind of a specific thing you're playing there, but it's actually, you know, very well designed for that solo aspect, better than a lot of games are. Okay, I think I've whittled on enough about skills here, so let's go on to another call. Well, we're going to finish the call from Daniel. Now, we're going to start getting into the idea of characters using weapons that their class normally wouldn't be allowed to use. We're not in the super spicy part of the calls yet, but we're getting there. Daniel, take it away.
As far as the sword thing, I remember when Eric called in, I thought I had called into your show, but I didn't hear my call. So maybe I didn't. But I think that, you know, the idea, and maybe Eric was being sarcastic, but the idea that a wizard can't even pick up a sword because it says that is just, I think that's just silly. That feels like a really weird rules interpretation. You know, the idea to me is that the wizard or the magic user is not trained in fighting with a sword. And yeah, you could pick it up and flail around with it, but people that are martial artists, not me, will tell you that, yeah, you're not going to – if somebody's attacking you and they are skilled with a sword, you might as well not have it in your hands. So that's how I always looked at it. Sure, the magic user could pick up the sword. They're just not going to be able to hit anybody. There's just no chance they can hit somebody if they're actually fighting back. Now, if, let's say, an orc was knocked unconscious by the sleep spell and the magic user walked up and picked up a sword off the ground, could they run it through the orc to finish them? Yes. And I think telling a magic user they can't do that would be kind of silly. That being said, I know why they have those things in the game, and I'm okay with the game being a game, right? That magic users can only use daggers because we're trying to balance the game. Clerics can't use magic swords and can't use bows because we're trying to balance the game. as soon as we try to make our D&D game real or realistic, that's when I think we start tripping over things. So a magic user cannot use a short sword proficiently enough to actually hurt somebody with it, but they certainly can use a sword for, they could pick it up and cut their bread with it if they really wanted to. Where I'm always, and this is kind of an up in the air thing, and now I'm just thinking aloud, is I always wonder though if a magic user could take, like, let's say an intelligent sword and take it and like have it and use the intelligent sword's abilities. My feeling is generally no, because I think the intelligent sword would not respect the magic user's prowess enough to allow itself to be used by them in that way. So that's my answer there. But yeah, I think that anyways, just the long and short of that is that I think that I think MW's got the right idea. You got to adjudicate at the table. I think that you never want, if something is a baked in ability, like a thief skill, then somebody shouldn't be able to do that thing just by rolling an attribute check. I think that would just be, doesn't make sense to me. Would I allow in the scope of the game and the story of the game, if you will, for somebody to learn how to pick a lock? Yeah, I probably would. I mean, why not? If it's something they want to study and try to do, but I wouldn't just let a random person do it. I think that just rolling under your decks to pick a lock is just not using that rule in a way that the rule, if you want to call it that, was kind of designed to be operated, in my opinion. So what's that rules as intended? Is that what that stands for, since we love acronyms?
Okay. So we've already kind of talked on that very last part of Daniel's call. I didn't want to cut it up and reorder it. I just wanted to put breaks in it. So that last part kind of goes to the skill discussion. I think we've already covered that. But the other part where he's talking about using weapons that the class isn't normally allowed to use, agreed. It's a game. There are game balance reasons that's in there. And I'll come back to that because there are a couple more calls and then I really want to get into that. But since Daniel mentioned the idea of the abilities of intelligent swords, I'll address that now because I don't think that comes up in the other calls. Personally, I wouldn't let a magic user use a sword's abilities. You know, that's something that, you know, that's one of the things that makes fighters cool. And Daniel well knows this. He's talked about this in regards to OD&D. You know, intelligent swords are a big pro of the fighter or the fighting man class, as it's called in OD&D. And that's one of the big benefits of that class because other classes can't use it. So I wouldn't let magic users use intelligent swords or their abilities. And there are plenty of ways you could do in-game to allow this. In Daniel's OD&D game, his clerics can't use magic swords because they have the souls of elves in the swords, and it's against the cleric's religion to be able to use them for that reason. And that's a good way to keep clerics from using intelligent swords. And you could do something very similar in your AD&D campaign. I mean, it could be as simple as, obviously, for intelligent sword to happen, somebody had to bond that intelligence into that sword. And maybe just because of that process, all intelligent swords hate magic users and won't activate and let the magic user use the abilities because of animosity from being trapped in the sword, right? There are plenty of ways to come up with that. But yeah, I would not let a magic user activate the abilities of a magic sword personally. And that's not penalizing the magic user. That's just, it's like, would you let a character, you know, like monks aren't allowed to use potions. So it's just a game thing. And I think it's a game balance thing that's worth keeping. Now, let's play these other calls. We have some calls from, we're going to finish Daniel's call, and then NW and Carl are also going to weigh in here. Now, Carl's going to slander the Grog Talk Emperor, and that is solely on Carl. I take no responsibility other than to, you know, ask his forgiveness due to his ignorance. But let's listen to these calls.
Finally, I'll just take a minute to which has nothing to do with anybody, but it rubs me such the wrong way. The idea of not allowing the magic user to get experience points because they use the sword to save their lives. To me, that's why people think AD&D is super antagonistic. You know, whatever, whether you play it that way and everybody's happy, that's fine. But not get experience points for the entire thing because you saved your life with a sword, that sounds ridiculous. Not get experience points for killing that one orc, yeah, I wouldn't give him that, but I don't do experience points that way anyways. That's just me ranting about AD&D. I'm sure I'll get a lot of hate for that, but you know, I just think things like that is so weird to me. It's like, we're going to penalize somebody for playing the role in the way the role will be played. And also, if you're a magic user and you've been magic usery for the entire adventure for three sessions, as you've been doing all the stuff, casting spells, staying in the back, never fighting because Gygax said you shouldn't, and then you stab one orc with a sword to save your life, you get no experience points or you get knocked down in a rating. That just sounds, no, not cool. Not cool for me, but that's just my opinion, as always, just like anything I present here, and not an opinion that represents Jason, who clearly says they shouldn't get experience points, so he's a big old meanie. I joke, of course. I'll talk to you soon.
Hey, Jason, just listened to a call-in show in my maybe 25 minutes of call-ins. Thank you for airing all of it. You didn't have to, but I appreciate it. Or maybe I don't appreciate it. I don't know. Who knows? Now I'm on trial. I think I'm on trial with the Emperor because I don't do things, always do things the way he does it. But you know, I was thinking more on this thing you can't use the weapons. Now, this, my phrasing saying, having players say, well, I can't use it. That comes directly from the language in the book, right? The book literally says weapons that can be used or can't be used. Now, I hope it says that. I'm actually out walking again. I try to walk on Saturdays. Long walks too, by the way. I'm now walking to the gym, over three miles from my house. But and then I'm gonna walk back after I work out. So, but the point is, I'm pretty sure the player's handbook literally just says, indicates these are weapons that can be used and can't be used. Now, here, I'm posing a question to you and all your listeners, Jason, and maybe people who are way smarter about these things than I am and the people I play with. Does that actually just mean the weapon you can't be proficient in the weapon, but it doesn't mean, like I kind of think, it's not really a blanket prohibition for using the weapon? And if that's the case, if it means clerics can never be proficient in slashing and pointed weapons, then I'd have to rethink the penalty. And actually, same for the magic user. So I'm going to listen, and if people respond, is it possible that Gary just neglected to say cannot become proficient in these weapons? And I'm going to go back and check the actual wording, and I might be able to answer my own question when I get home tonight. But if that's the case, then my long discussion about the weapons in your last call-in episode would be completely null and void, because then that solves the problem. Because like I said, the problem exists because the book really didn't provide much of an explanation of what it means can't use. But if in fact, it either indicates, and people are misinterpreting it, that you just can't be proficient in those weapons, then there is no problem actually. And this should never even come up during gameplay. It should just automatically be governed by the non-proficiency rules. Or perhaps the book doesn't suggest that, but this has been clarified some other place that I'm just not aware of, and the people I play with aren't aware of either. So that's it. That's a short one. 3 minutes, man. You don't even have to have a drink to listen to this call in. So this is MW Lewis, Worlds of MW Lewis podcast. Thanks, Jason.
All right, I feel like I have to respond, Jason, to this idea of the wizard or the cleric in a circumstance where it's a desperate circumstance and they have to, in order to save the party, pick up a weapon that they normally are not proficient with and use it. Now, I would impose the at-sight penalties, -5, -4, whatever it's going to be for them to attack, but if they succeed, it's a desperate situation. It's determined by the roll of the dice. So why would they be punished for, you know, XP-wise, or, you know, it wasn't that like voluntarily they went against their class. It just happened because of the dice rolls and the circumstances. I think that would be unfair. Like MW says, you know, he likes the yes and type of philosophy of game mastering. And I don't think you should punish them for a circumstantial situation. Now, again, if they involuntarily pick up swords and try to use them, well, that's their player agency and they voluntarily do it. I don't know who this freaking emperor is. I don't really care. I'm not a classist. You guys might be classist in the OSR, but I'm not a classist, so I don't care what this emperor says. But I think that would be unfair, and honestly, I would just leave the game. If someone said, oh, well, you know, in that really dire circumstance, you used a sword as a wizard, and now I'm going to penalize you, I'd be like, well, I guess I'm done. Oh, well, find other players. And maybe they would find other players, but I wouldn't play that game because that seems unfair and very arbitrary and adversarial. So there you go. You wanted an opinion? There's my opinion.
Nobody likes a quitter, Carl. I'm being a little facetious there. Folks, if you're in a game that you're not enjoying, you should not stay in that game. Okay? Don't feel you have to stay in a game that is not enjoyable to you, that you feel that there's hinky things going on in the game, stuff like that. There are plenty of people to play with, especially if you're playing online. So please don't feel that you're trapped in playing with a toxic group. That said, you're probably more likely to find a toxic group outside the OSR than inside the OSR, but that's probably a story for a different podcast. Okay, let's look at where do we get the idea of no experience and not gaining experience? Well, that actually comes from the rule books, but it doesn't come from the weapons part per se. So when we look at things like characters of two classes, dual class characters, then we see this. And this is page 33 of the Player's Handbook, where it talks about once you switch classes from one class to another class, until you reach the same level as your previous class, you can't use your old abilities. And if you use your abilities during the course of an adventure for your previous class, then you lose all the experience for that adventure. You don't gain any experience for that adventure. And that's specific to the character of two classes. But I think that kind of interpretation is where this idea came from. But if we look at the by-the-book thing, and MW's right, we need to go back to the text. So when we go back to the text, the word we see used isn't can, it's may. They may use. So, and where we look in multiple places in here, both with multi-class characters, we see the term may. For example, cleric combinations of fighter types may use edged weapons. Or when we look at the table that shows who can use what weapon, and this is on page 19 of the Player's Handbook, the terminology in there is may. A thief may use a short sword, broad sword, or long sword, but not a bastard sword or two-handed sword. May. So I think this can be solved two ways. One, 100% they can pick it up and swing it, but they're going to have their non-proficiency penalty no matter what. I think that's a given. So a magic user can pick a sword up and swing it, but they're going to have a -5 to hit. I think that is going to happen no matter what. I would let them have that chance to hit and do damage, though. Unlike what I think Daniel's suggesting, I would give them the chance to do damage, but they would have that -5 to hits. And, you know, they're wading into combat without armor. And so that's probably a bad situation. Now, if we want to look, and then we have the idea of the rating system. But AD&D First Edition, you know, the pure First Edition pre-1985 doesn't really address this. But when we go to later sources, we do see it being addressed. First, let's jump ahead to flipping and turning number 13. Flipping of Turning, of course, is the premier AD&D magazine being published today. It's Delph approved. Issue 13 is actually the most recent issue, I believe. It's autumn of 2023 issue. You can find it at www.smolderingdunggames.com. I'll put a link in the show notes. You can also get the digital version at their itch.io page, which will also be in the show notes. In the Gibbering Mouther section of that magazine, this question comes up. Dear Gibbering Mouther, in a recent episode of Grog Talk, Dan and James talked about whether magic users may use magic swords of their own creation, and the resulting conversation about it left me confused. Can you clear this up? Signed, Mageborn Swordsmith. So there's a page answer here, and I'm not going to read this because It's free on Itch, so you can go check it out yourself. But I will basically say that the conclusion that's come to here is that they would not get experience points for encounters where they used a weapon that's not permitted to their class. And then if they continue to use a weapon that's not permitted to their class throughout a campaign, intentionally avoiding their... And if they continue to use a weapon that's not of their class throughout the campaign, even though they've been warned that this is not magic user-like by the DM, then they would potentially be getting bad ratings, and it would take them longer, and it would be more expensive for them to train. And then they conclude by saying that it's true that Gandalf would not have gotten XP for his kill the Balrog in Moria. Now, this, if we only have the original books, AD&D first edition, then this ruling makes a lot of sense. And like I mentioned earlier, it pulls from the idea of character with two classes. So I think this interpretation is totally acceptable until we move on to AD&D 1.5. And we get into AD&D 1.5 in approximately 1985. And we know that the Grog Emperors and their domain kind of stop in 1985. So they can't be held responsible for rulings that apply to AD&D 1.5 era games. But if you are going to play a 1.5 era game, then we should look at the rules that define that era of gaming. So if we go to the book that shall not be named, Unearthed Arcana, and this is on page 13 of Unearthed Arcana, character classes, table 2, armors and weapons permitted. Underneath that, we have notes. We have general note, and this totally answers the question. Weapons not permitted to a character of a certain class may be picked up and used, but the non-proficiency penalty for that class will always apply, using the most severe penalty applicable for multi-classed characters. And such non-permitted weapons may not be kept and carried by the character for use later. So, by Unearthed Arcana rules, a character can pick up a weapon their class can't normally use and use it. They're going to have the non-weapon proficiency penalty, and they can't carry it around and keep using it normally. So this is basically the same thing that we got from Flipping and Turning 13, meaning that you can throw all those 1.5 books in the trash and just defer to Flipping and Turning magazine for any questions you have on these matters. But let's say you're going to insist on playing 1.5 edition. The rules don't say what to do in that case, but I think that's where the rating system comes in, as is laid out in Flipping and Turning issue 13. Because if they decide, hey, I'm going to carry the sword around with me all the time, that's when you start dinging them with a rating and giving them a poor performance rating because they're not abiding by the class structures that they should be. And that's all covered in the DMG. So I don't know, the getting no experience probably is an interpretation of the character of two classes and probably is a little bit too harsh and doesn't belong in the more Monty Hall style of AD&D 1.5 edition games. But I think definitely they'll always suffer the penalty for non-weapon proficiency. They can never become proficient in that weapon. And if they decide to carry it normally... And we're not talking about the last member of the party left, they're in a cave with no exit, and they have to pick a sword up to kill a lycanthrope. Okay. They carry that sword with them till they get out of there back to town. Okay, we're not going to give them a bad rating for that. But if they put that sword on their belt and walk around future adventures with it, then they're going to get a bad rating for it, right? That's where the rating is going to come in. So that's kind of where I fall in this debate, and I hope that answers some questions that have come up. That's all I have for you today. Thank you so much to all my callers. I really appreciate the feedback and the conversation that we're having. I recommend people go check out all those podcasts of my callers, Hindsightless, Bandits Keep, The World's M.W. Lewis, The Geomologist Presents, all great and exciting podcasts. And for the ones that have YouTube channels like Bandits Keep, and Geomologist Presents, check those out as well. Also, check out Flipping and Turning Magazine, highly recommended for all your AD&D needs. With that, I'm going to sign off. Thank you to TJ for the wonderful music. Thank you to Ray Otis for the coffee cup clip art, although we're using Yoda in today's clip art. And all that's left to be said is be excellent to each other.
Joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I fiddle shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. Butcher is a dustman and your moil is by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away.